Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Facebook.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We've got a guest with us here today who proves to be very interesting. In fact, I know he is. I've had a quick chat with him already. Stephen Elphick is his name. He's a photographer. He's a wine connoisseur, but more importantly, he's been actually judging wine since 1988. He's got quite a bio, and I'm going to let him tell us a little bit about himself and where we're heading today in today's conversation. So thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Thank you, David. My pleasure.
So is connoisseur a fair comment about you with respect to wine, or are you more of a photographer, or are you a bit of both? How would you describe yourself?
I think I'm obsessed by both.
Is that right, eh? Okay.
The wine obsession started probably in the late 70s and has taken me largely around the world from Argentina to Southern California and through the viticultural regions of Canada from coast to coast, and with brief forays into Washington, Oregon, New York, Pennsylvania,
wow. Okay.
Ohio, etc. That interest has also played out in the visual material that I've started in the 1990s as a part-time wine writer.
Okay.
There was really not much in the way of library of Canadian viticultural images for me to draw on to augment the stories I was writing. And it seemed that it was a it needed a focus, a world stage, if you like,
right,
for the Canadian viticulture. As the regions expanded, both in production and in, how would you say, notoriety,
right, good,
there wasn't necessarily a good visual context for them. So I started making photographs in the 1990s to reinforce my own image library and to bring material to the world at large.
Right. So you've been taking photos professionally for at least 10 years before you started doing the professional wine judging, correct?
Yes, I started making photographs professionally in 1976.
Okay.
And 10 years later was took the examination to be a wine judge.
Okay.
And at the prompting of a very well-known entrepreneur named Donald Zeraldo.
Okay.
Who suggested that I take the exam with a variety of professionals from other areas, both viticulturally based and in wine marketing.
So that's interesting to me. So I'm always interested in the connections. My background's philosophy academically. I love the whole notion of the little things making a big difference. The prompting, tell me a little bit more about that. Was it a party? Did you show some sort of skill that he hadn't seen before, or was it just kind of a friendly gesture?
Well, he knew me as an entrepreneurial photographer. He knew that I had a fascination for the wine business, as I had been purchasing wine at the newly founded Inniskillen Winery in the 1970s.
Okay.
So I was not an uncommon face. I was also affiliated with a number of his professional colleagues.
Okay.
And so...
So there was a network there?
There was a network there initially, and he felt that as a highly skilled individual in one way, I could perhaps benefit the industry and myself by at least looking at a palate test. And it grew out of a competition that was held every year by the Ontario Wines and Spirits Association, which was to find the best blind taster in Ontario.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And I won that
competition. Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's really, I think, what prompted it. There was a little Charna Star bio about the wine photographer who had won this palate test.
Right.
The palate test was quite complex, and the people in the room tasting were generally 20 to 30 years my senior.
Wow, okay.
And took it very seriously.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, I've seen a little bit of that culture sort of from the outside, I guess you could. I've never sort of stepped inside that circle, but it really does, like, the folks in there are taking these things pretty seriously. There's no fooling around here.
No, these are people with means and very deep cellars and a great passion for...
Nice metaphor.
Yeah, and a great passion for the grape, if you like.
Right. So was there kind of like I want to talk more about photography as well, and just I want to plant a seed here. You talk on your very small bio on your website, which is stevenelphick.com, by the way. That's StevenElphick, and I'll be mentioning that again near the end, Stephen. But you talk about truth and beauty. And I want to get to that in a second, but was there an aha moment for you with the wine or for the photography? Was there, on some level aesthetically, that makes sense that you're doing both and you're obsessed with both, to me. But can you talk a little bit more about when you knew that, wow, this was for me and I'm going to learn everything I possibly can about wine?
Well, I have a slightly obsessive nature, and I was teaching at Sheridan College, a course on the history of photography.
Okay.
That really encompassed the origins of image making and painting, and right up into the current technology of the time. So my obsession with minutiae wasn't exclusive to photography. I had a fascination for wine, and once I got into it, I just applied the same kind of template to my learning about fine art photography and the history of it. I just took that to the next level with the viticultural world. So my interest then blossomed and expanded, and then I thought, well, you know, here's an opportunity for me to hybridize my my two obsessions.
Right.
So that's where that started.
So you're a man of details.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
So do you live in a very clean apartment or house?
No, I live in a 19th century farmhouse in northern Toronto.
Oh, okay. Well, there could still be a lot of reasons to believe you're a man of details from the place you're living in, or not so much?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So minutia for me has got a bit of a pejorative edge, but it doesn't sound like it does for you.
Well, the world is obviously full of information, and it's the filter that we apply that makes it interesting.
Sure.
So in this particular case, the academia obsession, or the ability or interest in pursuing a particular subject to a profound end, is really, I think, what drove my interest in both skills, both the viticulture and the enology, I suppose, and in photography. I've always been deeply fascinated by technology, but also deeply fascinated by landscape and beauty. And as an image maker, I did photograph a lot of landscape in the early part of my career, and wandered around sort of AKA Ansel Adams with view cameras and sheets of black and white film, and you could only take a couple of dozen frames a day, because
right.
that was how many film holders you would carry with you.
Right.
So your ability to analyze landscape was fairly highly honed at that point, because you rejected a lot of material.
Right.
Because you only knew you had 20 pictures today. It's a far cry from the digital age, where the economic problem of having large amounts of film has largely gone away.
Yes.
You know, every time you took a picture, it was sort of a $5 adventure.
Right. Right. Of course. Yeah.
Plus also the back end darkroom time. So the same thing sort of happens with the wine side. You know, you're really quite fascinated, but you apply the filter and you start being very particular about what you taste, and have a great respect for the other professionals who manufacture the product,
mm-hmm.
and their dedication as wine growers and viticulturalists and ultimately farmers, who are completely dedicated to their craft. And that was a very interesting opportunity for me to look at that business, and
mm-hmm.
it seemed to have some mirrors in my business.
Yeah.
These people were highly skilled. They had enormous amounts of respect for the land, and were required to make a living.
Yes.
So there was and still in the same way now. And I would say that we in Canada are seeing great advances in technology. We're certainly seen it in the 30 or 40 years we've seen in Canadian viticulture and winemaking.
Yeah.
As it's sort of mirrored in photography too.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talk about filters. I mean, it's, you know, you're using filters in both, the winemakers are using filters of various kinds, photographers, or as you call yourself, an image maker, using filters of various kinds. I think it's an interesting metaphor for a whole lot of things.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's that particular, I mean, both it's a physical thing, and we all use glass filters.
Yes.
The other guys use micropore filters.
Right.
But the ability to take, you know, large amounts of entropic information and distill it down to very organized information, both on the chemistry side and on the visual side, are pretty good mirrors there as well.
In one of our first conversations, I think when we've only met, by the way, folks, digitally, we were introduced through email and then had a conversation. Stephen and I haven't actually met face to face. We're going to sort that out in the near future. But Stephen, you talked about blanking the other senses, as a wine taster, I believe. But I'm wondering how that can apply to photography and other crafts, as you say.
Well, I think that cinematographers and photographers enter into the world of image making, and I suppose painters too, where they shut down a lot of their sensory information and heighten other ones. So I'm not so much thinking about olfactory when I'm making photographs. I'm thinking about a highly visual sense, but I'm not thinking much about visual when I'm tasting wine. As a matter of fact, you know, when you really are in a wine judging situation, the cursory glance to make sure that the wine is the right color is the first thing you do.
Yes.
But then you close your eyes. And sometimes you close your ears, too, and really try and concentrate on the olfactory side of that experience so that you're hunting for many things. You're hunting for the expression of terroir and of place. You're hunting for whether there's a flaw or whether it's just a profoundly magical experience for you. And so, you know, we're all hedonists at some point, and photographers are notorious for being addicted to the instant gratification aspect of image making. And that's not that similar mirror here in the wine judging arena, where you're looking for instant gratification, but you're doing it by shutting down certain senses and heightening others. Photographically, you enter into an entropic world with, you know, a lot of not very interesting information, and it's your job to frame that in the perfect light and reject images that you're not interested in.
Is the way to become a great judge of wine partially by drinking a lot of wine? Is the way to become a great photographer, a great image maker, by taking a lot of photos? Because I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get to is, how do you hone that filter? How do you develop a framework that enables you to I guess cast judgment one way or the other, or to actually, you know, take the picture and make a call about this particular bottle of wine?
I think exposure is a critical thing, and as many people have likened image making and it, perhaps even wine judging, is to being an athlete. It's repeat, repeat, repeat. Repeat and learn again, repeat and learn again. And I think that without much exposure to a broad variety of wine products, you are limited to what you can say about them. And what we've seen currently, what we do see currently, is a predisposition worldwide to follow a style which is not the style that we saw in the 70s and 80s. I guess historically, great red wines were, you didn't drink your cellar, you drank your father's cellar.
Right.
You drank wines that were 25 or 30 years old. Well, in our world now, people are not interested in waiting 25 years.
Right.
They'd like something today. And I think the LCBO statistics say 94% of all product is consumed within 24 hours of its purchase, and maybe even 4 hours of its purchase.
Yeah, I had a friend recently say to me, I mean, why would you want to save a bottle of wine? You know.
Well, and that's because winemaking technique has really embraced that whole philosophy, which is new.
Yeah, sure.
I'm very privileged to be able to taste 19th century wines with a small group of gentlemen who have that obsession. And that's a learning experience, too.
Yeah, I would imagine. I don't know if you'll chuckle or be disappointed at this, but I opened a Pinot Noir recently that I had brought home from a trip in 2003, and you're probably going to tell me, I'm probably just, you know, I'm showing my cards here, as they say, but it was, I think, it was definitely spoiled. I let it breathe for quite a few hours, and I guess I didn't make it through my cellar, my makeshift cellar, I'm sorry to say.
Well, if it's 2003, it's a pretty hot year in Europe, and it would be maybe not as well structured as a 2002.
Oh, okay.
The 2003 was the hottest summer in Europe in 100 years. And so certain varieties didn't get the long hang times. They were harvested early.
All right, and so I don't have to blame my cellar, is what you're saying.
Not necessarily. No, and it was a tough year for people in 2003, because a lot of people brought the stuff in early, but it didn't have a lot of flavor. It just had lots of sugar.
Interesting. Okay.
So a lot of it can be vintage variation.
Yeah. You also talked about in our first conversation about the process being highly analytical, and I wanted I wanted you to unpack that for me. Background's philosophy, distinction between analytic and kind of continental, and here I am sort of, you know, pushing the divide forward, and I really don't have that intention, but there definitely does seem to be a distinction between those group of thinkers that are, I don't want to say left brain and right brain, but, you know, highly analytical. And so they're the philosophy of science and the mathematics and logic and so on. And then you've got this other group of thinkers that are not systematic at all, that are you know, the French and the German thinkers in particular in the late, mid-20th century, late 19th century and so on. And much more intuitive, much more kind of poetic almost in a way. And I would think to be a great photographer or a great wine judge, you've got to lean more towards the intuitive side than the analytical side. Could you talk about that a bit?
I think that with many things, there's a template that we follow that's fairly well defined.
Okay.
Certainly on the wine judge side, you sit down, you are presented with a product in a glass, you look at it, you smell it, you make some olfactory and tactile notes, and then you ultimately make a decision based on historical reference.
Okay.
And I think that is not that different a template in photography. You sit down, you look at your environment, you assess where you are in that environment, what light is doing in that environment, mm-hmm. or you're creating light in the studio situation to provide you with a very particular kind of environment that mirrors let's say bright early morning sun or something very subtle and quiet like overcast day.
Mm-hmm.
Those templates are followed again and again and again to the point where they're just kind of in your back pocket. And you don't think of them in terms of analysis anymore. You just employ them. So it kind of frees you from... once you've learned those rules, you're then free to, I guess, approach things on a more intuitive basis.
Mm.
It's like...
It's kind of like writing poetry.
Without the tools, how do you write poetry? You know, how do you... I mean, I've been writing for a number of years as well, and I find it a profoundly uncomfortable experience.
Yes, I've done a little bit, and I find it, I love it, and yet I find it infuriating at the same time, and very difficult, actually, to do.
And I know quite a number of writers who can sit down and write, but they have very particular tool sets that they've honed mm-hmm. over a great period of time. So then it becomes, you've got the tools, then it becomes a more intuitive world. Because the tools just come to you.
You've built the foundation. When you mentioned historical reference, what do you mean by that exactly? Is that your schooling that you've done, or
And many people, it's university degrees, and many people, it's the school of hard knocks.
Right. Sure.
All of which is incredibly valuable, and as you say, you are educated every day. It's just. Is that education formal or informal? Are you obsessed with information retention and perpetual learning, or are you willing to sit down and just settle for what you learned when you were 20 years old?
Right. We can't talk about wine and not talk about Sideways. I don't know where that movie sits in your top 10 or your top 100 list, but it's certainly on one of my lists. Loved it a lot. And Virginia Madsen, I believe her character talks, there's one beautiful scene, and you and I chatted a bit about it the first time we talked, but she talks about the life of wine. And I watched it a couple of days ago as I was thinking about our conversation coming up, and she talks about it's beautiful, it's poetic, she just rolls off her tongue. I mean, do you buy into that? Would you say that she's right about that?
I think that, you know, scripts are romanticized everything.
Yes, of course.
Because that's their job.
Yeah.
The great fascination for me for that film was having... sort of trekked through that little piece of Santa Barbara or Santa Maria Valley area where the cast goes.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mecca for California Pinot Noir. It is a very special place. The farmers there are very obsessed and very, very clear about trying to reach a certain pinnacle of expression. And philosophically, I suppose you could have any one of them discuss endpoints for their wine.
Right.
But they're all trying to mirror the great wines of Burgundy. The particular terroir doesn't necessarily mirror that, but perhaps one of the viticultural regions, which is a sub-appellation called Calera, the gentleman smuggled vines back from the great vineyard of Richebourg in Burgundy.
Huh.
So his obsession starts with, how can I get the best plant material into a terroir and create the next great wine in the world?
Right.
Richebourg being one of the most extraordinary wines of the world, and most expensive.
Right.
So, philosophically, everybody is grounded in philosophy. In fact, the viticultural world is full of philosophers, strangely enough, who are winemakers and own wineries. Len Panichetti from Cape Springs, I believe, has a doctorate in philosophy and was teaching at York University. And his winemaker, Ange Pavan, was one of his master students. So philosophy is not unknown in the wine world. In fact, it's quite normal.
In vino veritas.
It is.
Yeah. So you would consider yourself a bit of a philosopher?
Well, I don't know that that's an easy identification. I would have to go to Wikipedia and look.
Right. Well, how about the pursuit of wisdom? I mean, you talk about truth and beauty on your website and in your biography, and I mean, you talk about yourself being obsessed. I certainly know a lot of philosophers and academics who are obsessed with an idea and unpacking it in various ways. So I'd love for you to talk about that truth and beauty distinction, but also, would you call yourself a curious person?
Extraordinarily so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I have my long-deceased grandfather took me to the library every Saturday morning from the age of about four, and that was our job, is to go and be engrossed in books.
Right.
From a very early age, and books were to be revered, and knowledge was to be revered. So it stayed with me. I'm certainly curious and certainly try to explore new things all the time.
And yet you wouldn't call yourself an academic, or would you?
Only occasionally.
Only occasionally. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, because it seems to me, it sounds like you were on your way to becoming an academic almost, and with your grandfather?
Yes.
Taking his library, that I think is wonderful, wonderful that you have that memory, but also that, you know, just, you know, for me, books are just central to pretty much everything. They're doorways to other individuals, they're doorways to other lives and cultures and so on, and there's a sense in which I sort of cherish books as well, and without idolizing them, if that makes sense. And so it sounds, though, like you kind of brought various disparate sort of worlds together and as you learned how to make money doing this, you know, which I think is wonderful, that this isn't just something that you do because you love it. You've been able to live as well. I mean, and one only has to look at your website briefly to know that you're a pro at what you do.
I think that, you know, I it's sort of an odd confession, but it is in some ways my sacrament. It is what I don't want to do anything else.
Right.
I feel compelled to make photographs.
Right.
It isn't kind of an optional part of my life. It may be because my family is, you know, composed of sort of a number of painters that go back a few generations, and I consider myself a bit of a lazy painter, if you like.
Right.
But I don't think about doing anything but what it is I'm doing, and I try and continue to move forward and provide myself with more and more challenges within the framework of this business. We just finished a big book last year, which was about 1,600 hours work on analysis. And it was a lot of very early mornings and late evenings, waiting for the sun to go up or come down, either or. and was an enormous challenge for me visually, as I had to basically record the same thing over and over again, but provide very particular signatures for each property that I visited. And so we did that with color, and we did that with light.
Right.
And it took my world of very controlled image making and made me think about things in a different way. It made me think a lot about color, which is which was quite exciting too. So compartmentalize a project. On Monday you would be looking at a property, you'd go in and you say, well, the colors here that are profound are cyan and red. So that's the color signatures that we'll look for in this particular property. And on Tuesday you're somewhere else, which is maybe just across the street, but you're looking for new color signatures so that you can differentiate one from another visually in a large volume, which is going to hold 300 or 400 or 500 pages, so that the reader is stimulated and continually excited by page to page.
And, and this book is just looking at different vineyards, basically, in Ontario?
It's wineries and vineyards.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, if you go outside into the world at large and stand in the middle of a vineyard, you see in a landscape that's profoundly blue and green, and maybe not that very much variation in it. And if you have to do that every day, then you have to kind of look for something that's not blue and green.
Right.
So that means going at sunrise and going at sunset and employing all your senses, or your visual senses, to get you to a new place every day and get you stimulated every day.
You, you've called yourself an image maker several times in our conversation today, and I'm wondering, I mean, is that a conscious decision on your part?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, some of the material I do doesn't look much like photography.
Interesting. Okay.
It looks maybe more like illustration, or, and it's not material that's on my website. It's new material that I'm working on. But as I get older, I tend to, things are getting less cluttered.
Right.
And more pure, and are relating less to, it's perhaps a rejection of the material that I see in the world, of highly organized and very noisy photographs that have a lot going on in them. I tended to move away from that into very quiet images that are perhaps a more zen-like or more instructive of positive-negative space, and are enigmatic, and people don't necessarily know what they're looking at.
Right. You use the word sacrament. It almost sounds like there's a spiritual quality to some of the images you're taking, or at least you're trying to create.
Well, not necessarily the, content-wise, but there is always a kind of spirituality in making the photographs. You put yourself in an altered state because you are blanking out the rest of the world, and all you're doing is making photographs.
Right.
And I think that altered state is common for many people in a lot of different things. I think musicians carry it. I think photographers and painters, cinematographers, lots of people do that. It's just that you don't express it very often.
Do you think there's, because of the, you know, I forget what the crazy statistics are with regard to images. We see, I don't know, 13,000 a day or something ridiculous. Somebody needs to check my numbers on that. But, you know, when you look at the internet, you've got, you know, our browsers on our Blackberries and our iPhones, television, magazines, newspapers, et cetera, billboards, and so on. So it's hundreds a day. Do you think there's something about the ubiquity of the image that has, I was going to say maligned the photograph, the image, what it actually can be. So I guess in a sense we've lost this ability to, I don't know, make a distinction between something that's artful and spiritual and holistic and meaningful, and it's just become a mere ad, you know, kind of a simulation, if you will.
I think that we have an enormous amount of stimulus, and I think that the ability to disseminate the information quickly and without filter, again, is troublesome sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that by going into institutions like art galleries, and you know, there is a filter there, And it's an enormous filter, and mm-hmm. and a lot of the ephemera has been cut away, and we're just presented with the best. We're not presented with the best so much, and I don't know how much people do filter anymore. I just don't have that kind of information.
Mm-hmm.
I find that there is too much information on a regular basis that I'm confronted with. And again, this may be my current image making, may be a reaction to that, where I try and distill it to something that's less and less.
Right.
And that's really a very interesting observation worldwide, to see how much material is available electronically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that within the large cities where there's internet access all the time is different than perhaps 200 miles from a large city.
Right.
Where people aren't as obsessed with technology.
Right, and as being connected so often, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's a regionality aspect to it as well.
So believe it or not, we're coming to the end of our interview, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about maybe you want to talk a little bit more about your book, but also just about Canadian wines in general. You got in about some 30 years ago, and you've talked about revolutions, and you've talked about trying to recreate that experience from the greatest Burgundy wines in California and so on. Where are we at from an Ontario perspective? I certainly am enjoying a lot of whites these days. I'm doing a lot of experimenting with Canadian wines. And for various different reasons, but I've heard we're knocking it out of the park when it comes to whites, but not so much with reds.
It's still a cool climate that we're in. We're not in the warmest climate like California, although coastal California is pretty cold as well. White wines were certainly, we were described as an American by an American wine writer as one of the great undiscovered Chardonnay producers in the world.
Oh, wow.
And that was just last year. And so we are now seeing a concentration certainly on that particular varietal, on Chardonnay. And the winemakers who are making the most extraordinary wines certainly have made wines in Burgundy and use the Burgundy model. Because it's cool here, we get we're not obsessed with high sugar levels, and I've tasted our wines in context with great Burgundies, and they stand up.
Hmm.
They are extraordinarily good wines.
Hmm.
So in terms of red wines, in a good year, hot year, we will see delicious wines. There's great winemaking going on. Sometimes it's a mirror of world appellations that have given us reference points, and sometimes they're different. We're beginning to see great Gamay here, although Gamay is perhaps not the the most known grape variety.
Mm-hmm.
It's the grape variety of Beaujolais. But we are still looking at highly skilled men and women making delicious wines that will rival anything in the world.
Wow.
In terms of longevity, I can't say that Ontario Reds have the longevity of other places.
Right, okay.
But I can certainly...
So you're not seeing a lot of Ontarian wines in people's cellars at this point?
You've seen a lot of Ontario wines?
You're not going to see a lot. You're not going to get 10 and 15 and 20 years out of Ontarian wine at this point.
I've tasted wines back recently with some of the winemakers,
uh-huh.
back into the 80s and early 90s, and I think that they are not. Yeah, I think you are absolutely right.
Right.
They are to be enjoyed in their youth for their freshness and,
right,
and
right.
brightness. And that is also not uncommon with places like Beaujolais.
Right, right.
You know, you don't drink cold Beaujolais very often.
Right.
And Loire Valley, same thing.
Yeah, it's not necessarily negative.
It is not negative.
Yeah,
you just have
yeah.
to know that it is not Burgundy.
Yeah,
it is not Bordeaux, it's Ontario.
Well, this is where, you know, your notion of historical reference becomes so important, right? Because I've seen a lot of wine drinkers that are quite snooty about what they drink, and they're not interested in drinking Ontario wines. Oh yeah, no, it's I'm a wine drinker.
Well, it's reference points, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It's reference points. And,
yeah.
and I understand that completely. Would I drink Ontario Cabernet over Great Bordeaux? Well,
right.
That's a good question. If money is no object.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, who's buying the bottles? Yeah.
Yeah, and we are seeing, and I talked to one of the winemakers recently, and he said, you know, there is a little bit of emperor's new clothes going on here, and he's convinced that we should be competing in a different price point, and his philosophy is going to drive his farming and his marketing of his product over the next 2-3 years, where they have looked at $50 price points in let's say Burgundy and $50 price points in Ontario, and it's apples and apples. You
right,
know, you can
right.
can you pay $50 for one and have the same experience as $50
right,
for the other?
Right.
And the answer is perhaps not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's so many factors. One of the things I've got to say just before we sign off is, I've joked with other friends when drinking wines. I don't consider myself to have a very mature or experienced palate, but I do know what I like, and I certainly enjoy wine. But I love the way connoisseurs, judges, writers speak about wine. Did we just drink the same glass of wine? you know what I mean? It's just it's wonderful. It's just, and this is where you come back to that whole life of wine. You know, the crisp nature of it, and it's bold. And I mean, it's just, it's wonderful. It's, do you have a little wine thesaurus that you carry around with you?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a little wine thesaurus that you carry around with you, looking for ways of describing the taste? It's just, it's marvelous to me.
No, but I've practiced a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I think that the one thing that you're not seeing that's being explored enormously in California is the notion that there's physiological differences between tasters.
Mm, okay.
That
it's
the
great.
Number of papilla on the tongue and how people perceive things.
Yeah.
So there's like super tasters, tolerant tasters, and intolerant tasters.
Right.
Some people, the intolerance, like, you know, kind of sweet, syrupy, big,
sure.
flavorful wines. And the super tasters find those wines extremely hard to manage.
That's such a great way to put it. Yeah, hard to manage. Well, and so we're back to perspective.
We are back to perspective,
yeah.
and everybody is right.
Because yeah.
if you're not judges are often super tasters, and so you get really bogged down if the wines are clumsy and sweet, where intolerant tasters might like everything on the table.
Yes. Right.
So there's got to be something out there for everyone.
Yeah, I hope I'm somewhere in between, being intolerant and super taster.
Most people are. And
yeah, yeah.
And it also branches out into what other things you like in
course.
The world of,
yeah.
Do you like black coffee? Do you like
right.
Coca-Cola?
Right. Yeah,
cetera,
the type of scotch you drink, maybe? Could that?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
is, each taster
yeah.
is
no.
based on the tasting elements that people enjoy puts them in certain categories.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us today. It's Stephen Elphick. For those listening, that's Stephen with a V, StevenElphick.com. Check out his site. Quite a portfolio there. And do you want to just talk really quickly about the book that it's just recently come out, Stephen?
It's called Spectacular Wineries Ontario. It was commissioned by a publisher out of Texas, surprisingly enough.
Interesting. Okay.
It was an opportunity for me to visit wineries from Windsor to Picton, and from Niagara to Georgian Bay.
Wow.
It's a pretty interesting geographical overview, and I think that it's a visual feast. So.
No, that's great. Well, thanks very much for your contribution and for chatting with me today. It's thanks for joining us on Face to Face.
It's a great pleasure, David. Thank you very much.